Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. And as always, along with your call, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, an interesting article that came out of Great Britain that shows that IQ use and drug abuse may go hand in hand. Very interesting, kind of provocative research about that. And I've got a theory about that. And stem cells, interesting information that came out of the American Heart Association meeting, where your own cells are then re-entered into your heart if your heart is damaged and may regrow. Some very interesting
stem cells. That may actually happen.
They've happened. They may regrow. I mean, like I said, it's an experiment. One experiment doesn't mean it actually works. Very, very interesting data.
Mm-hmm. And our recipe?
Garlicky kale with bacon. If you've been looking for a new way to eat kale, I know all of you kale users out there looking for a new way to have kale, you may want to consider turkey bacon. It's an interesting recipe. I know Tom is biting at the bit, waiting to learn new ways to eat kale because he wants a kale and tofu recipe.
Our toll-free number again is 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, let's welcome a listener now in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Well, I have two things going for me. I have problems with it for the last 8 or 9 years. Mm-hmm. Been to a number of doctors, and the two terms they come up with is one on my hands for nods. The second one having to do with my feet, and they call it neuropathy. And I've had, I'm taking right now some pills called Gabapentin, 300 milligrams, to help the nerves in my feet a little bit, but it just seems like I'm walking on leather and my hands are, in any kind of coldness at all, are just about ready to drop off.
So how long have you had the Raynaud's for?
Oh, boy. I've had the Raynaud's probably 8 or 9 years.
8 or 9 years. Okay, so you've had Raynaud's 8 or 9 years. Raynaud's phenomena, not uncommon. We get questions like this commonly on the show. It's when your hands are, for instance, touching a cold steering wheel, and all of a sudden they can become painful, uncomfortable. They can turn white. They're due to a vascular sensitivity in the periphery of the hands. Hands and feet can both have Raynaud's, but hands are pretty common. What do you do for the Raynaud's? You wear gloves all the time?
When I go running in the morning and stuff, that's the worst time. And so I wear two sets of gloves. But okay. If I touch cold water mm-hmm. in the morning or something like that, it's even worse.
Yes. So the answer for Raynaud's is basically to glove. Like you said, if you touch cold water, what you want to do is you want to put gloves on. You know, when you wash dishes, if you're washing dishes or you're having the water, you put gloves. And that's really the easiest non-pharmacological way of treating Raynaud's is you have a variety of gloves around the house. You know, big rubber gloves for dishes, you know, gloves when you're going to go outside and work in the garden, gloves when you're going to, go outside and run. There are pills that may help. Some of the pills, which are called calcium channel blockers, which are a blood pressure pill, sometimes will help with Raynaud's, but it's a pill you have to take every day, and it's sort of plus minus. So treating it that way is about what you can do. You can't cure it. Sometimes it's a side effect of some medications. Are you on a beta blocker?
No.
No? You're not on any blood pressure pills at all?
No, none.
Okay, because beta blockers can cause Raynaud's like that. So that's all you can do for Raynaud's. Now let's talk about your feet. Mm-hmm. Peripheral neuropathy is uncomfortable. It's something that people do not like. It's a bummer to actually have. Do you have diabetes?
No, I was checked for diabetes. That's the first thing my doctor did.
That's right. First thing you check is for diabetes. Do you have a B12 or folate deficiency, vitamin deficiency?
No, we did blood checks, and I'm taking an extra pill of folate anyway.
Okay, and that's one of the other things. And then there, if you look up peripheral neuropathy, if you Google peripheral neuropathy, you'll see a whole list of things. In fact, we'll put it on our website at Zorba.com. pastor.org if you find it through the web or through Facebook. Okay. We're going to put a list of all the causes of peripheral neuropathy, and there are a ton. There are just a ton of different causes. And so sometimes you go through one after another, and then you kind of get tired because there's also idiopathic peripheral neuropathy, which means we don't know what causes it. And that's actually responsible for quite a bit after you remove diabetes and a few other common causes. So gabapentin, which is the drug that it sounds like you're on, is a commonly used drug for peripheral neuropathy. You're taking it once a day at bedtime, or you're taking
it? Taking it once a day in the mornings.
In the mornings. And well, let me talk a little bit about that drug. There are a number of drugs that help in peripheral neuropathy. Gabapentin is one of them. Lyrica, which is a name brand similar drug called pregabalin, is another one. The maximal dose of that, some people need up to 800 milligrams three times a day. That's a lot. Most common side effect is sleepiness. I have a lot of people on 300 milligrams three times a day, and it controls it. Doesn't get rid of it, but they say it doesn't bother them. And if it bothers you at nighttime when you're going to sleep, I think you need a nighttime dose. You know, kicks in about an hour later. Usually, if it bothers them when they go to sleep, I tell people take it at 8 o'clock at night. That's what I do. Take it with your 8 o'clock ice cream, little dish of ice cream.
Sure.
My father always had ice cream 8 o'clock at night because before he was in the gumball business, he was in the ice cream business for years. So, but anyway, at 8 o'clock in the evening, you may want to take it. I tried at night. If that doesn't work, I'd take it twice a day. It tends to come and go. It's probably never going to go away. Blood pressure doesn't go away. Heart disease doesn't go away. Cholesterol doesn't go away. So a lot of our problems don't, but we treat them. And the gabapentin is what to do, as long as you rule out those other problems.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for the call at 1-800-462-7413.
You know, for some people, that is the first sign of diabetes. The first sign of diabetes can be, gee, my feet, I just don't know what's going on. It's painful and uncomfortable, and you find out they've had diabetes for a number of years. So if you've got something that's like a peripheral neuropathy, numbness, tingling, pain in your feet, see your doc, get checked for diabetes and certain vitamin deficiencies.
Hmm. Let's see if we can help a listener now, Zorba, in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Hello, fellas. Zorba, I'm kind of interested in a second opinion. I had a naturopath talk to me recently about pH balance in my bloodstream. I come from a family where we had rheumatoid arthritis. That was the diagnosis back in the day. I'm 60. And so far, I've been able to avoid anything like that for any extended period of time. Occasionally, I would have tenderness. Especially if I happen to bang my knuckles or bang the sides of my hand on something. But that would be temporary, and I'm not altogether sure why it would happen and then not happen. But recently, my hands have been kind of tender. I'm a musician and an artisan who works with my hands a lot. I looked up the acid and alkaline foods lists on the Internet, and come to find out, virtually everything I'd been eating, 80 or 90% of my diet, was acid-producing foods. So I'm wondering about switching that around and the results of pH balance in terms of tenderness. In my case, it's mostly my hands, sometimes my elbows.
What do you play? What instrument?
Mostly I play banjo.
Uh-huh. Well, you have to have
good
hands.
Nobody likes to hear my music, but I play anyway.
As long as you like your music, that's what counts.
Yeah.
That's
you don't have your banjo handy, do you?
I do, but I don't have any way to strap the phone to my ear and play for you. You wouldn't want to hear my phone popped up.
Oh, no. We're always interested in music on this show. Music is one of our muses. You know, and Tom is a French horn player.
Yeah,
French horn player.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's never played on the show. Tom, why haven't you played on the show?
There are good reasons.
Well, how about this, Tom? You play the French horn, and I'll play the banjo on the show.
There we go.
All the listeners away.
There we go.
I'll give you a call when I'm ready for that to happen.
So first of all, getting to the rheumatoid arthritis, you may have the genetic predisposition to it. You may not. And, you know, genes play a role. They're not the whole role. They're part of the role. We don't know why. For some people, it kicks in, and for other people, it does not. So, you know, you've avoided rheumatoid arthritis. Doesn't mean you avoid it forever. But, hey, if you're 60 and you've avoided it, that's good news, you know. Because the chances are you're not going to get it. Now, getting back to the pH balance, I must tell you, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in the pH balance issue, because if you measure pH accurately in the blood, for people. It's a very, very standardized, regulated thing that occurs within the body. In other words, we regulate our pH very specifically and very exactly. And things that change our pH are very interesting. Chronic lung disease. So you, if you have emphysema or chronic bronchitis and you don't blow out your carbon dioxide, you tend to retain it, your pH changes. And we can change our pH right now if you take 10 deep breaths and you breathe it in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out to try to get rid of the carbon dioxide as quick as you can. You can feel a little dizzy. Mm-hmm. And that dizziness is a result of the pH change that occurs. Mm-hmm. But a number of naturopaths say, you know, this, they measure your pH, you know, they'll take a bit of blood and they'll say, well, you need to have this and need to have that in order to stabilize the pH. And I don't see any science behind that. Now, that doesn't mean that taking some natural vitamins or changing what you eat may not make you feel better. It may indeed make you feel better, but I don't think pH is the issue. And I don't believe in that particular measurement. I just want to tell you why I have that opinion. I don't like to use quasi-science. If you're going to use science and you're going to measure pH, then I think you've got to have the whole ball of wax of all the science behind pH. In other words, you can't just take out the part that allows you to sell the vitamin or the item. You have to take out all the science concerning pH in the body. If you want to sell the vitamin and you want to say, this will make you feel better, and I have anecdotal information from people who used it, I think that's fair game. But I think you can't take out pH and say, this is it. And if you're going to actually have it studied, it's got to be in a referee journal that's scientifically sound. That's because where I come from as a scientist. So,
yeah, so I think what I should do is just take several deep breaths whenever my hands feel tender, and that'll probably help.
And call me in the morning. The old doctor is at it. So.
Okay, I'll take 10 deep breaths and call you in the morning. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. So you say, Zorba, there's a study showing a link between IQ and drug use?
Yeah, very, very interesting. This is a study of 8,000 people, started in 1970. It's a British study, UK study. And they looked at IQ scores at the participant and when they were 5 years old, measured it, validated scale, mm-hmm. looked at it at 10 years old also, the same thing. And then they asked them, they did psychological surveys. This was part of a longitudinal study, mm-hmm. looking at psychological distress and drug abuse at the age of 16 and then at the age of 30. So it's a longitudinal study. And at drug use, they looked at marijuana use, cannabis use, cocaine, uppers, downers, acid, heroin. And at the age of 30, 1 out of 3 men and 1 out of 6 women had used pot. Mm-hmm. Certainly not unusual. I'm sure our numbers in the U.S. are the same or even higher. Mm-hmm. And about 8% of the women, 8.5% of the – rather 8% of the men and about 3-4% of the women had used cocaine in the last 12 months. I mean, that's a fair amount of coke use that's there.
Yeah.
When intelligence was factored in and they got rid of things like socioeconomic level and other things, they found that IQ scores, and they looked at IQ scores once again at the age of 5, mm-hmm. that if you had a high IQ at the age of 5, you were 50% more likely to use amphetamines, ecstasy, and several illicit drugs, things that are really harder drugs, 25 years later.
Very interesting. You think that more intelligent people would be less likely to take drugs?
Well, that's been the whole theory, is that brainy kids are much more likely not to use drugs and more likely to have healthy lifestyles. And researchers said that it might be that brainy kids are more easily bored, you know, and basically I think there's some very interesting issues here, you know, from a parenting point of view, mm-hmm. quite often parents will say, well, you know, the kids are okay. He's getting an A in school, so he must be doing everything okay.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think this may be, if you will, a marker for parents who are stepping back and looking at test scores in mm-hmm. school as showing that their kids are doing okay.
Yeah.
When in fact, there are really multiple intelligence, Daniel Goldman's concept that you've got multiple intelligence. You've got IQ intelligence. You have street smart intelligence. Yeah. You have drug intelligence. Mm-hmm. You have social intelligence, and these kids have IQ intelligence, and maybe they're left on their own.
Yeah.
You know, or they're smart enough to sort of manipulate their parents. But I think from a parental point of view, it means if your kid is smart and bored in school, mm-hmm. you have to do a better job of mentoring, because that child seems to be more likely to use drugs.
Very
interesting. I think it's kind of a red flag for us.
Now, you at a very high IQ when you were a kid.
No, I was not a high IQ. Yeah. It was not IQ.
Yeah,
high IQ.
Yeah,
oh, no,
did.
No, no.
Yeah, you did.
No, 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 Tom.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Now let's change the topic, Zorba, and move along to a listener in Westfield, Indiana. Hi.
Hi there, Zorba.
How can we help?
I'm very nutrition conscious. I read the health magazines. I get flyers, newsletters, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it boils down to always we need to eat whole foods. They say eat whole foods and whole grains. And what exactly are the whole foods? I mean, obviously I know what a whole carrot is or mm-hmm. celery or potato and tomato and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the grains, you know, we don't eat grains of wheat or grains of oats generally, although I can sprout wheat. I've never tried the oats.
Mm-hmm.
So what are whole grains when it comes to things like that? And then also swinging over into the oils, they're always talking about saturated or unsaturated oils and so on. I generally always use olive oil because I've come to learn that that's the best. So I'd like your thoughts on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, some interesting questions, I think, Zorba. It's not always easy when you go to the grocery store to know what the good whole grains and whole foods are because the labels are totally deceptive. And
absolutely.
What exactly is a whole grain or a whole
food? Yeah, because we can attack all of these the same way. So first of all, whole grains. One of the issues really has to do with when you have, for instance, a wheat berry, you know, so a wheat berry. The wheat, when you refine it and you make white flour, you basically are removing the hull and you're removing part of the germ. And that's really what contained the vitamins. And if you look back to the 1900s, when people were eating nothing but refined, we'll say, flour, mm-hmm. they were losing some of the B vitamins that would be present in the hull. So when we look at whole grains, what we're looking at is things such as whole wheat flour. So when you buy bread, you want it to be whole wheat bread. Now, the problem is if it says whole wheat, it isn't. There's whole wheat and there's whole wheat. In other words, some may be a ratio of 1 cup of whole wheat flour to 4 cups or 5 cups of white flour because we like fluffy bread. Mm-hmm. And one may be, half and half whole wheat flour and white flour. If you just use whole wheat flour, and I'm a bread maker, I love baking bread. If you just use whole wheat flour, you have a very dense bread. It really is very difficult to taste and difficult to chew. So often a mixture is good. So whole grains essentially means that you are not getting rid of part of the grain that often has vitamins in it. That's it. And we know that it also is a fiber issue. So whole grains mean more fiber, which in the end probably means less colon cancer, less heart disease, less stroke, lower blood pressure because, you know, fiber is good.
But is it easy to find these whole grains?
Well, first of all, it has to say whole wheat. It has to say a whole grain bread. That means it's going to have more. You find one that tastes good to you, and generally one that is heavier and thicker is going to have more whole grain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the whole grains are. And when you're baking, you want to use something like whole wheat. Now, what about oils?
Mm-hmm.
Well, saturated and unsaturated. Generally, animal oils are saturated, and most vegetable oils are unsaturated with one exception, stick margarine. Stick margarine has trans fats, which we know are not good for you, and also will often have hydrogenated fats. When I was a kid, my mother would cook with Crisco or Spry that she took out of a can. Why? Because it was saturated. And then, lo and behold, back in the 60s, they found out it should be unsaturated, polyunsaturated, and we went to vegetable oils. The best oils to use are canola oil and olive oil.
Yeah, I cook my popcorn in a regular peanut, but you're recommending canola is better, right?
Peanut is okay. Canola is better, but with 2 tablespoonfuls, it's not going to do much. So thank you for listening to your show, and keep up the good work of thinking about nutrition.
Okay. Thanks, Zorba.
Sure. Zorba, before we head out for a short break, it's time for another edition of your favorite segment, Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's dissent deals with your comments about our European listeners, more specifically, their shower habits. Several of our friends from abroad
flooded our inbox to set you straight. I'll let one sum up their argument, writing, "Dear Dr. Zorba Pastor, you perpetuated a myth on the air. You stated that Europeans shower less 2 times a week or so. I am from Europe, have recently arrived here, and have family and friends in multiple countries in Western Europe. I have heard of this belief in the USA, and I have to tell you, it is complete and utter nonsense. I believe this story was told first after the Second World War, when your soldiers came home. Back then, this might have been true. However, none of my rather extended family nor my friends in 5 countries shower less than 6 times a week. Basically, everybody showers every day, and that has been the case for at least 35 years. I am rather offended you perpetuated this myth because you're basically saying we stink. I advise you to back up such statements with reputable research.
Well, I stand corrected. I must admit, you know, I mean, no harm, no foul. I can, you know, obviously, you know, this person took it in a way that was not appreciative. So I will stand back and say, yes, our European friends must shower as much as our Americans. Maybe this is just an urban myth that I have perpetuated. So I stand corrected. Thank you.
Did you like my righteous indignation?
I thought it was great. You infused yourself into the email.
Those Europeans shower more than
that's
I do.
Right. That's right. You're not. That's it. You got it, baby.
Well, you don't have to disagree with the doc every day, but in the rare case that you do, make sure to send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a recipe coming. I was going to say a yummy recipe, but I don't think so. Anyway, that'll be coming up next. We have some more interesting topics to talk over. Our medical myth buster, too. Stick around right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, we have our recipe, and let's see if we can just breeze through this thing in a hurry, Zorba.
Why?
Maybe we can get to something good after
you
that.
You mean because kale doesn't interest you.
Exactly.
Kale doesn't interest you. You know, this is garlicky kale with bacon. The only thing missing is tofu. Garlicky kale with tofu and bacon, and that would be it. Now, kale is a much maligned green.
I mean, when rightfully people
think
so.
Rightfully so. Not for everyone. The kale producers of America will line up behind this and say, you don't really understand kale.
Yeah.
I mean, kale has a place in the American diet.
Okay.
That's it? No argument about it?
No. You know,
just want to breeze through. I mean,
not in mine.
How about
if this
were garlicky lamb chops with kale and bacon? That's it, because you could push away the kale.
Yeah.
But the problem with kale, of course, is, you know, it has a bitter taste.
The problem with kale is it doesn't taste good. I love it.
There is no way that I can convince you that there is a place for kale in the American diet.
Right.
Okay. But for those of you who really believe in kale,
I mean,
if you're passionate about kale,
right.
I don't know if anyone could really be passionate about kale.
Right.
But if you can tolerate kale and if you think you want to try something
different. This is a good way to do it.
This is a good way to do it because we're using bacon. Now, a lot of kale users poo-poo bacon and think the bacon is bad for you. But I ask you, are there more bacon eaters or kale eaters
bacon
in America
today? Bacon is bad for you.
Bacon in large amounts are bad for you. But I predict that after this recipe, McDonald's will soon have a cheddar milk with bacon and kale.
I love it. I love this recipe, it has kale. Something that tastes awful and something that's awful for you.
That's
one recipe.
You see, and actually, we should have a whole side group of recipes like that. Something that tastes awful and something that's awful for you. And we could have it. In fact, you know what? That's the next cookbook. That's the next cookbook.
Foods that taste bad.
I don't want hard, healthy, guilt-free, and tasty foods in the kitchen of Zorba Pastor.
All right, let's
foods
do this.
Foods that taste awful or are awful for you.
All right.
That's exactly it. We've got it here. Okay, garlicky kale with bacon.
Right.
You know how to spell kale. Kale is spelled with a K.
Yeah.
You knew that.
Yeah.
Okay, two large bunches of kales. You've got kale, not kales. Kale, you've got to take the ribs and stem discarded and coarsely chop the leaves.
Okay.
Coarsely chop the leaves.
Got it.
You know, for large kale leaves, you kind of have to roll them up and slice them.
Okay.
You know, that's it. You're done with the kale. You don't have any other questions about his slicing.
Okay.
Two slices of bacon chopped.
Two slices of bacon chopped.
Now your mouth is watering, right?
Not exactly.
No, not exactly.
Yeah.
Three slices of turkey bacon chopped.
Three slices of turkey bacon chopped.
That's right. Two cloves of garlic minced.
Mm-hmm. Two cloves of garlic minced.
3/4 cup of low-fat chicken broth.
3/4 cup of low-fat chicken broth.
That's right. A splash of red wine vinegar.
One splash of red wine vinegar.
Salt and pepper.
S&P.
And a juice of one lemon.
The only time I like bacon is with eggs for breakfast.
And so any other time, I don't
go for the cheeseburger bacon.
Really? No. But you like cheeseburgers.
Do
you like cheeseburgers or just burgers without cheese?
Cheeseburger.
Yeah, onions or
but
no
the
onions?
Bacon is overkill.
Yeah.
And I don't think of bacon any other time of the day than morning.
Than morning. But you know something? You're old-fashioned.
I am.
Because if you go
I'm old,
to any
too.
You're
old,
that's right. You're not really old-fashioned. You're old. But it's not just for breakfast anymore. I mean, people are eating bacon, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Okay, all right.
And I've got a cousin in Chicago who does pork, used to do pork bellies, and now he does hogs. He's a speculator, and he said, bacon is hot. Yeah. I mean, I don't mean that as a
I'm sorry
joke.
I digressed here, but
it's okay.
Any excuse
that's okay. You're
to not
to
talk
about
kale.
That's right. Not talk about kale.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, in a large pot over medium heat, cook all the bacon until crisp, okay? Mm-hmm. Remove the bacon from the pot with a slotted spoon, reserving the oil that's there, okay? Then add the garlic to the pot and saute until brown. That's under you know, light heat. Make sure it cools down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then add the kale leaves to the pot and toss them until they're wilted and bright green. So they're going to change color. It's not going to be iridescent green. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be just a brighter green.
Okay.
Which is a good sign. That means the kale is fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Then add the chicken broth, a little splash of red wine vinegar, partially cover, simmer for about 7 minutes till the leaves are tender. You've got to cook kale. Most people don't like kale because they don't cook the kale enough. You've got to cook the kale.
Okay.
They're kind of like greens, you know, like a green chino is a southern dish.
Yeah.
You've got to cook
it
enough. Toss the leaves with some bacon, season with salt and pepper, squeeze a lemon wedge over each serving and enjoy. So it's a very interesting taste. It's sort of like greens,
mm-hmm.
collards,
mm-hmm.
which I tend to like. And, you know, it's a good dish. And it's a good dish to try with your family if you want to try something different that they may like. Once again, the bacon is making the dish, to me, taste better. I'm an omnivore. I like things that have a full taste to them. If you mm-hmm. want to get rid of the pork bacon and just use the turkey bacon, it's okay, but you're probably going to have to add a splash of olive oil then.
Yeah, race to the computer so that you can get this recipe.
That's right. You can get this recipe. You can get our calorie count also. Go to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can download this recipe. You can download other recipes because all of our archives. You can download our podcast. By the way, we have a weekly podcast. It's the entire show that's now on our podcast at zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413, 1-800-462-7413, and Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in West Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. What's up?
A few weeks ago, I heard a spot on your show about the negative effects of alcohol and a lot of the sort of unforeseen effects and how deadly it is. And I just wanted to get your take on what's known as the French paradox, that the French have incredibly low rates of heart disease, but their wine consumption is nearly double that of the U.S.
Mm-hmm. We have to look at what they do. A few things. First of all, their beer consumption is less than ours. So they drink less beer and they drink more wine. And they don't drink as much hard alcohol as there are in other societies. They drink with their food. They don't drink on an empty stomach. So they don't – that's much more common where they drink and eat and socialize at the same time. So it might be – and 1 or 2 glasses of alcohol a day are safe. That's exactly it. And that's the data is once you get over 2, then you start to go down a slippery slope of increased risk of heart attack and stroke. But 1 to 2 a day are safe. So they sit down with food, savor the food, and drink their wine. That may be part of it. Part of it may be when you're doing slam drinking, for instance, and you're binge drinking, which more Americans do than the French. So they drink more beer and more alcohol on an empty stomach to get drunk. That's different. And that may be different than the consumption of 1 or 2 glasses a day. But you're right; they do consume more wine, but they have it with their food. So, now, do you like wine?
Yes.
Yeah, red or white, or what kind of wine do you like?
I'm a fan of the big dark red wines, like Malbecs and things from the Bordeaux region.
From the Bordeaux. And you drink it? How often do you drink it?
I probably have a glass or two a night.
Yeah, it feels good. It's interesting about the resveratrol and the grape juice because we've tried to separate the alcohol from the wine and say, you know, can we do it without the alcohol? And the studies have been a dud. And one of the reasons we do the studies are, first of all, some people are alcoholics, so they can't drink it. So take that 10 or 15% who are alcoholics or have trouble out of it. And then some people don't want the inebriation of wine. I don't drink it every night, but I drink it 3 or 4 days a week. But I think the other part of it is we have a puritanical society, and something that's good for us must be bad for us. So if we sit down and we enjoy the red wine and we get a little buzz from it, there must be something wrong. So what we want is sanitize the wine and get rid of the wine portion and make it into just grape juice, which we know just produces obesity. So I think part of this is kind of an interesting social aspect. I think a glass or two of wine or a glass or two of beer every night is just fine and healthy. And I recommend doing it the way the French, the Greeks, the Italians do it, with food, sitting down, savoring the moment.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You're welcome.
800-462-7413.
So do you like a Malbec or do you like a Merlot? What kind of wine, red wine do you like?
I drink very little wine.
Uh-huh. See, do you drink beer? Do you drink beer?
Very little. I don't know. I'm just not much of a drinker.
See, now I like I wouldn't call myself a drinker, but I like a glass of wine probably most nights of the week. And I have these little corks that you can buy in the wine bottle so you don't have to finish the bottle. I mean, it makes a little vacuum in the bottle.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, which is good.
Well, before we take a short break, Sorba, let's play another round of Stump the Doc. Our contestant today is Kim from Spooner, Wisconsin, who's having spine-tingling troubles with ice cream. Kim writes, I've never had a brain freeze while eating ice cream, but I often have a sensation of it going down my back. When this happens, it is painful, and I wiggle and try to put my back into the chair I'm sitting in to make it stop. I've not met anyone else with this problem. My husband says I'm nuts. I tell him a brain freeze is just as crazy to me as ice cream going down my back is to him. Have you ever heard of this? Ice cream lover fearer.
Ice cream lover fear. Well, first of all, a quote, a brain freeze or an ice cream headache is caused by stimulation of the trigeminal nerve. And these are the nerves that feed our face. Mm-hmm. They cause extreme pain, sinus pain, tooth pain are all mediated by the trigeminal nerve. And by the way, to avoid doing that, having that happen, of course, you eat ice cream less, a little bit, more slowly, less quickly. And if you take your tongue and you put it to the top of your teeth in the front of the hard palate, mm-hmm. you will actually decrease the risk you're actually going to get, quote, a brain freeze. It's a way of actually eating ice cream and not getting it as much.
What about this back freeze?
Well, I know, the foggiest idea. Now, I don't think she's nuts. I mean, she's obviously not nuts that you have it, but obviously it's stimulating some other nerve in her head, mm-hmm. which is causing it to go down her back. And the problem with ice cream is you can't eat it warm. You've got to eat it cold.
Right,
By
right.
definition, It's ice cream. So, A, you're not nuts.
Yeah.
But B, I don't have the foggiest idea why it's happening. But I think it's probably mediated by other nerves in the brain that are obviously stimulated through the same pathway as the ice cream.
Probably by going back on the chair and pushing on the chair with her back is about the only way you can do
it. That's about it. And eating ice cream more slowly. That's part of the issue. But I would also try the trick of the tongue, once again, to the top of the palate, push towards the front, just push towards the teeth, because that decreases the ice cream headache and it may help her back discomfort so she can enjoy ice cream.
I think you can stump Public Radio's favorite family doc. We'll then send your questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have more of your calls coming up, another interesting topic to talk about, and of course our medical myth buster. Stick around with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our phone number again is 800-462-7413. But before we take our next call, Zorba, stem cells and damaged hearts, some interesting research.
Right. This was recent research presented at the American Heart Association. You know, stem cells have a lot of promise. They have a lot of promise, but actually using them in humans and getting results has not really been tried very much at all. You know, we try it in animal models, mouse models, other models, sheep models, and the promise is there. But with humans, it's really an issue. And this is a fascinating, fascinating research study. And they looked at arteries that were blocked. If you've got a 98% blocked artery in your heart, it's called a widowmaker because quite often people die when they actually have it. And they looked at some people who actually – this was one of the patients that they actually did this study on was a 39-year-old with 30% of his heart damaged. So in other words – he had lots of premature heart disease. 30% of his heart was gone.
Serious stuff.
Serious stuff at the age of 39. So he then became involved in this risky clinical study, was the first patient ever to be involved. There were a number of patients in the study. What they did was they went into the heart and with a tiny pinchers took out bits of healthy tissue from his heart. Okay, so they went in, took out bits of healthy tissue, then took it out, you know, woke him up, put it in a petri dish, grew the stem cells, which were heart stem cells, and then later on went back into his heart through a catheter, I believe, or through another method, and actually put these tissues, his own tissue, which they had grown in a petri dish, around the heart where the heart had actually died. In other words, part of the heart tissue, which it wasn't working. And lo and behold, he had improved function. In other words, it was like putting new tissue in the point, in the area which was not working, and his heart got better. And so they had 25 volunteers, very small study. 17 got stem cells. 8 got standard heart care, no stem cells at all. All the stem cell recipients had their heart attack scars. These are scars after a heart attack, reduced most dramatically by up to 50%. So in other words, repopulating the scar with normal tissue so that the damaged muscle is replaced by new healthy muscle. This is a major breakthrough.
Yeah, really. Sounds like it. As you say, it's been a long time we've been talking about stem cells and stem cell research.
This is a major, major breakthrough. So that first person, as I said, had 30% of his heart damaged, huge amount. He now has no shortness of breath, no pain. He's back to normal again. He's a 39-year-old who's actually functioning in a normal way. It's sort of like a magic pill. It's a really important issue. And this may be a new way to repair hearts that are significantly damaged.
I'm excited about it.
No, it's very exciting.
Stay tuned.
And I think what's going to happen is people with serious congestive heart failure who are looking at a heart transplant are now going to look at stem cell improvement.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, we take a call from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Yeah, I had heard a question about somebody had high blood pressure from eating licorice. And I had the opposite problem because I have low blood pressure, and I was getting symptomatic with it. And so I started taking licorice root on purpose to try to raise my blood pressure. So I think I lowered it inadvertently, trying to reduce my cholesterol. And now I just was wanting to know, with it being licorice being a potassium, you know, robs your potassium, is there a danger in doing that? Or?
Yes, that is the danger. That's exactly it. And that's what's very interesting about this FDA warning. First of all, do you like licorice? Do you like black licorice?
Taste of it. I don't ever usually eat it, but
yeah,
I don't mind it.
Yeah. So you don't hanker towards it. You don't say, wow, there's a great big pot of licorice. In fact, I've never walked into a house where somebody has like a great big bowl. They might have a bowl of chocolates, but I've never seen a bowl of black licorice, you know. But black licorice itself contains a chemical. I think it's called glycyrrhizin. I don't remember quite the name of the chemical. By the way, there's real licorice, and then there's fake licorice.
Right, we talked about that.
Fake licorice contains anise oil, and real licorice contains this other chemical. Yeah. And what they said was basically 2 ounces a day in somebody who's 40 years of age or older, and I don't know where they got that number, can significantly affect the potassium and lower it. And the issue with lower potassium is that it can cause cardiac rhythm disturbances. In other words, it's actually bad for the heart, especially if it gets too low. So for people who are on diuretics or have heart disease or have other medical problems, it's probably not a good idea. And you're right. If you were taking potassium root to lower your cholesterol, it might just lower your cholesterol, although I question that. However, it's going to lower your potassium. We now know that. And that's true. And it's not really good for you. You don't even look, and it's not even as if you're a potassium eater or a licorice eater. Right. So.
Right.
Should she be eating licorice or not?
Well, I wouldn't do it. If you're having trouble, have you had your potassium checked?
I've had my blood work done recently, a complete panel, and nothing was ever flagged on it.
Yeah, if potassium isn't flagged on it, I don't think you're going to have much of an issue, number one. But number two, how high is your cholesterol? Do you need to be taking this black licorice root?
Well, I didn't start it for the cholesterol. I started it for the blood pressure.
Oh, then I wouldn't take it. There's no reason to do that.
Okay, what can I ask then? What would you recommend to do naturally to raise the blood pressure? Because I was even getting symptomatic in the gym where I would almost pass out, and I was able to naturally lower my cholesterol by 100 points because it was up to 270.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's pretty high.
When I lower the one, it lowers also the blood pressure too.
Right, and so you don't really want to have that. So my recommendation is a Mediterranean diet, which is really a cardiac prudent diet. That's going to be the best thing, and we'll put that on our website, zorbapastor.org. You can find it on the web, and of course, remember, you can always find us on Facebook too. And I'll give you the Mediterranean diet. That's the best thing to get a normal blood pressure and a normal cholesterol. Number two is the DASH diet, D-A-S-H. It's a different diet, excellent diet to maintain perfect blood pressure. And we'll put that on our website too. Both of those are what I would look at. And what you've got to do is follow those, and those will make a difference. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye. Now, before we leave the licorice issue, an important issue that has been bothering me. I forgot to ask you about it the last time we talked about it.
Is this a red licorice issue?
No. It's a pronunciation.
Pronunciation. Okay.
It's spelled licorice.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it pronounced licorice as I've always pronounced it?
I pronounce it licorice. I don't pronounce it licorice. Licorice.
I've always said licorice.
That's disgusting. That's a disgusting
What's
word.
What's disgusting licorice. About a pronunciation?
It's licorice. It sounds like something bad. Licorice. That sounds something, you know, I'd eat.
What about Jewish? Scott, is that
Jewish.
Bad?
Well, how about British? British.
Yeah, I know.
British. That's Amish. That's not bad, too. But we won't get into words. This is not wordplay.
Licorice.
This is not
licorice
wordplay.
Guy.
I'm a licorice person.
And
I'm
you just said my person. Way, licorice.
And I like blackerish.
Double
that. I think it's good. Black licorice. Yuck. But black licorice. Give me that.
1-800-462-7413 is our telephone number. That's 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, it's that time in the hour where we get to our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with two of your favorite things, coffee and naps. It's long been thought that the two are mutually exclusive, but is that true? Does caffeine consumption affect your ability to nap?
Well, you know, I mean, I love to nap. I love to nap in the middle of the day, especially in the summer when it's beautiful outside. Mm-hmm. First thing I want to do, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon is take a nap. But also, when I drive long distances, and for the first 10 years that I lived in Madison, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. we went to Chicago every 6 weeks to visit our relatives with our kids in the car. Yeah. And sometimes I went to Chicago because I did some work down there, and I'd be really tired. I'd pull over to the side and take a nap. So which is more restful? Well, there are some very interesting studies. Caffeine helps. We know that. You know, good cup of coffee, strong brew.
Helps.
helps keep us stay awake. Keeps us awake. But naps also help us. And it turns out that caffeine may be better than a nap, but a caffeinated nap was better than either one individually.
Well, that's the question, because can you have caffeine, which tends to keep you awake, and then nap?
Well, there was one study which looked at the ability to actually engage in activity, you know, where you had to be aware and awake, mm-hmm. where they took a cup of coffee, they drank a cup of coffee, and then they immediately went to sleep and took a nap, because caffeine takes about 15, 20 minutes to kick in. You know, 200 milligrams of caffeine, you swallow the coffee, and what happens is it doesn't kick in for 20 minutes. So these people actually were very, very tired. They drank a cup of coffee and immediately took a nap for 20 minutes. And then when they woke up from their nap,
the
caffeine had kicked in.
Yeah.
So my recommendation now, if you're really tired in the middle of the day, is the best of both worlds. Drink a cup of coffee and go to sleep.
That's really
sleep
interesting.
For 20
and
minutes.
Then you'll wake up.
You won't wake up and the caffeine will kick in at the time you wake up. I think we've got a new thing, and I'm going to give it a name to it. It's going to be called Zorba's Caffeinated Nap. That's what we're going to talk about, Zorba's Caffeinated Nap.
Well, don't you get caught sleeping on your myth. Just send it to the show. To be busted, just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, the number to call. 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, listener with us now in Viroqua, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I had something happen to me. I was moving, and I hadn't been eating all day. And it was about 10 o'clock at night, and I was hungry, and I had some bananas. So I ate a banana, mm-hmm. and it was good, mm-hmm. and it tasted really good. And so then I had another banana, and then I was still hungry, and so I had a third banana. Mm-hmm. And then I started feeling hot or feverish. Mm-hmm. I took a cool shower, and when I was drying off, I discovered I was covered with hives. And my eyes were bloodshot, and I don't know. I've never had that kind of reaction from bananas before.
Oh, sure. Let me talk a little bit about hives. First of all, hives occur in a random fashion. So you don't want to blame it on the fruit. You want to just say you had hives. And of course, we blame it on what we ate. Strawberries are an example of a fruit that does cause hives. They're not unusual. Bananas, really, really rare. So I would not say that you are allergic to bananas at all. I mean, you had three bananas, you took a shower, and you had hives. Hives can come from cold weather or cold water. Hives can come from hot weather, hot water. That we always try to – we immediately, when we have hives, we look back and we say, what caused them? But I have to tell you, 50% of the time, we don't know what causes them. They just happen. So I would not give up your bananas. You're obviously a banana eater. You obviously love bananas because you had three bananas a day. Now, if every time you eat bananas, you get hives, that's a different issue. But it is really, really rare. So what I would go back is I'd go back to your banana a day, see what happens, and then I'd find out if it's the number of bananas. You know, if you have a banana a day, you're fine. But every time you pork out, although that's not the right
phrase.
Porking
out on bananas.
But you might find that when you have three bananas, you have a side effect. I doubt it. I think basically you just had hives and you happen to eat a banana and that's the way it went.
Is it possible to get too much potassium?
Not really. Bananas have potassium, but you really, unless you start to eat probably 20 or 30 bananas, it's not going to make much difference. And let me tell you, I doubt if you'll eat that many, but I must admit, I have patients that weigh 300 to 400 pounds, and some of them, I'm sure, go down and they get a bunch of bananas and consume them. But you, on the other hand, I'm sure won't do that.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for the
good
call.
Good luck, and thanks a lot. And I happen to love bananas. They're my favorite fruit.
Yeah, I do too.
Now, before we leave for the week, let's quickly log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help a listener named George and his quote-unquote silly question. George writes, "This might be a silly question, but here goes. I deliver for a major sub sandwich chain, and I just noticed that their bread has partially hydrogenated oil in it. I stopped eating it, but it gets baked in the store, so my question is, can it be absorbed through the air, or is it a negligible hazard?"
It definitely cannot be absorbed through the air. I mean, you can smell oil, and you probably, you know, you can smell it in your lungs, but you don't absorb it through the air. So as long as you don't eat the hydrogenated oil, which, by the way, just is not the best stuff for us in the world, but tends to keep our baked goods if you will, fresher longer, which is one of the reasons that it's used. It's really what you consume in terms of what you eat. You can't absorb it. There's no such thing that I know of, like there is with smoking. There's passive smoke, but there isn't passive oil ingestion.
Well, now here's my question.
Okay. You've got a question. Oh, great. Tom has a question.
No, an ethical question.
Ethical. Tom has an ethical question.
If you're a delivery person.
Yes. Okay.
And delivering something with hydrogenated oil.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you believe this is not good for you and don't eat it yourself. Are you being a bad person for delivering? Are you violating your ethical code by giving this product to somebody else?
You're asking me? I'm not an ethicist. I'm a doctor. I mean, that's a very interesting question. I think the answer is no. I think that you don't have a duty to actually tell people whether or not what they have is good for them or bad for them. So that would imply that if you're working at a convenience store, if every time somebody pulls out a cigarette, should you say to them, you know, this is bad for you?
Yeah, but what if...
a drink. You're having two drinks. Should the bartender say, this drink is bad for you, don't drink it? I don't think you've had two drinks. You shouldn't have three drinks.
Okay. See what the listeners
So it's very interesting. You think they'll have an opinion?
I don't know.
I wonder.
We'll find out maybe. See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg are the two honey badgers on the other side of the glass responsible for this mess, and they don't care. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1126Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.